Mainstream media is dominated by the right and the left.
The majority in the middle are left without a voice.
You've reached the Conservative Hippie Podcast, a common sense look at life, the universe, and everything. Here's your host, Jay Fratt, the Conservative Hippie.
This is a very special episode of the Conservative Hippie Podcast. I am joined today by Tom Luongo, host of the Gold Goats and Guns Podcast, my future friend and ardent libertarian. Tom enjoys mixing history, philosophy, economics, and politics into a personal blend of astute commentary on our current global structure and predicament. He might prefer the moniker of market analyst, but you could also call him a geopolitical pundit of the highest degree. I highly recommend giving his podcast, Gold Goats and Guns, a subscription. You might find enjoyment in cranky critiques of modern political battles, insightful analysis of world economics, or philosophical theories on comic books relating to modern society. His podcast is like mine in that each episode is whatever Tom wants it to be. All right, let's begin. Okay, you're exactly right. Let's go ahead and do this. And thank you again, Tom, for joining me. I've got some curious questions. I've read a lot of your work. Folks, there's going to be links in the show notes if you want to go see some of Tom's writings. He's been all over the place writing for national digital publications. He's been working on this for a long time. But my main question, Tom, as a fellow libertarian, just to let you know, my libertarian street card is I voted for Harry Brown in 2000. Okay, so
yep, so did I. So that was the first election I ever voted in, actually.
Okay,
so I was a real libertarian before that. I refused to take part.
So you have a little more bona fides. You're a little more hardcore. I'm libertarian light, okay? But there's one concept that I've heard, and a lot of staunch intellectual libertarians will throw this out, and it sounds crazy, and I just want to understand the concept, and I want to share it with my audience because I have a lot of middlers, and these people in the middle, you know, a lot of times I try to throw them towards the Libertarian Party. But there's this term that's extremely confusing. It's anarchist capitalist and
anarcho-capitalist.
Yep. Anarcho-capitalist. Thank you.
Yes,
Tom. Just tell us, what the hell does that mean?
It's actually a misnomer, because capitalism itself is anarchy, right? And anarchy is not chaos, right? We, you know, in the political discourse today, it's really difficult to separate all these terms, because everybody wants to do the Orwellian newspeak thing on terms they don't like.
Yes.
In order to grind their political action. We see it on the right as well as the left. It doesn't matter. The Marxists are more adept at this than the fascists are on the right, but that's it doesn't matter. What anarcho-capitalism is very simple. Is that the capitalism, when fundamentally broken down, and when you marry it with the non-aggression principle, which is the underpinnings of all libertarian thought, you wind up with a very simple definition: the voluntary exchange of goods and services. We don't need a government regulating that market. It's an anarcho-capitalism. It was a term created by Murray Rothbard. And he even had a problem when he created the term in the first place. He's like, it's not really even accurate because it's so redundant. Because capitalism in and of itself truly does imply a lack of government necessary to regulate people's economic behavior. Now, I happen to think that all human behavior is economic at its core, or at least can be described in economic terms. And remember, economics is just a metaphor for the way we just go about and doing our thing. It's just another way it's another overlay, or, you know, it's a filter that we use to describe our actions. It's like mathematics, right? Is a language we use to describe the physical world.
Yeah,
right?
A structure of organization, a way of describing that.
Right. It's just, you know, so when we start talking about these things in these terms, we remember that we're talking about it at the philosophical level first, and always in defining our terms and all of these things. And then once we've defined the terms, then we can start defining problems, specifying problems, and then we can start talking about how to implement solutions. And those are three very, very difficult, different steps. So anarcho-capitalism is really just capitalism, the voluntary exchange of goods and services between willing, informed consenting individuals.
Okay.
You can describe the cutoff date, you know, for, you know, when you think a person is capable of entering into a contract willingly or knowingly, and all of that stuff. Is it 14 years old, 18, 21, blah, blah, blah. We can have that discussion. I'm not here to have that discussion, right?
Yeah.
But it's all based on, you know, and the tenets of contract law and all of the things, and even in many ways, English common law are based on these very similar concepts, right? English common law, for all intents and purposes, outlines basically three crimes: theft of property, murder, which is theft of life, and fraud, which is theft, which again is just theft of property or theft of reputation. Right.
Yeah, it's gotten so confused in today's day and age, where property is no longer associated with violence, and you know, especially in 2020, where it almost seems like property crime is less punishable in some way, but that is violence committed against somebody who owns real property, and that's the basis of our society is are those rights.
Well, it goes even deeper than that, Jay. When you really start to analyze what property is, and I absolutely recommend for your audience, even if they're not, you know, even if they are middle of the road conservatives and whatnot, I absolutely recommend that they read the best of Murray Rothbard, and it starts with The Ethics of Liberty. I cannot recommend that book more highly to someone who's confused about, you know, where the line is drawn between conservatism and libertarianism.
Yeah.
Because Rothbard lays out the ethics for why individual liberty. And it's a philosophical text as much as it is an economic text. And then obviously there's other things by Murray, like Man, Economy, and State and others that you can draw your own conclusions from there. But what Murray does in The Ethics of Liberty is to take the normative description of Austrian economics and marry it with the positive aspects of the non-aggression principle to form, you know, the bridge between those two things. And honestly, the guy you should really try to interview one day on this very subject, who knows far more about it than I do, or would do a better job of describing it than I am, because he's been doing it for 40 years, is Walter Block over from the Mises Institute. And Walter would love to, I'm sure Walter would be happy to sit and chat with you about that. And I can do an introduction to him, because I think he's probably the one person over at the Mises Institute who can best describe the differences between Austrian economics and libertarianism, because they are two separate things, but there's a tremendous amount of overlap at the Venn diagram. Okay.
Okay.
Again, because one is, you know, because they're both outgrowths of the non-aggression axiom, but they have different goals in mind. And they begin, but, you know, at the end of the day, they start to merge into a cohesive view of the universe. That's the first thing to say. The second thing to say is that everything I'm going to say this afternoon, we're going to chat about in this, is not meant as we need to implement this today or tomorrow or anything else.
Okay.
This is a system by which to view the world and understand where the breakpoints are and where the fault lines are within our world and where we get wrong in our politics and our policy and our this and all of these things that we discuss when we break these things down into individual issues of the day. I don't care if it's abortion or taxes or you know, privacy rights or any intellectual property, any of these things. This is not about me living in an ivory tower saying y'all don't do this well. It's a matter of, I use this anarcho-capitalism and the non-aggression axiom as a means by, one, something to live up to in my daily life, right? How can I remove me aggressing other people as much as possible in my life, right? So how can I remove myself from the support system of the state, which supports violence, you know, unintended violence.
Yeah. Okay. I'm going to stop you for one second, because I think what you just said is extremely important, because any times I've come across anarcho-capitalism and someone speaking about anarcho-capitalism, it sounds like they're wielding a stick that they want to throw into the system to replace something. And that's always confused me, because how do we get there? It seems extremely difficult. And therefore their whole point, their whole conversation gets blown up because of the impossibility of implementing what they think we should all live by. And so I really appreciate those words, because it tampers down the extreme nature of what we're talking about.
Yeah, and this is the very subtle point, because look, we were libertarians, or hardcore libertarians, are incredibly bad at marketing.
Okay. Yes.
We've got logic on our side. We've got, you know, the arguments on our side and all this stuff, but we're terrible at marketing because we keep forgetting that you don't market from the head to the heart, but from the heart to the head. You have to remind people that people react emotionally to logical arguments, right? Yeah. It's why advertising works the way it does. It's why Apple is so damn successful, is because, you know, Apple understands marketing, and they always have. They've always been incredibly good at it. It's why, you know, the TiVo failed, because they, you know, and lesser products. It's why the iPhone or the iPod worked, and why the Zune didn't.
Yeah.
Right. Microsoft always thought that they were competing on spec.
Yeah.
As opposed to how the product made you feel, right? And the kind of person you would want to aspire to be. The iPod, and then eventually the iPhone, was something that, you know, it was a thing that represented the kind of person you wanted to aspire to be.
They sold, okay. Yeah, they sold a lifestyle and a freedom, right, in some ways.
Yes, absolutely. And so we libertarians are terrible at this. And I've been working, and I identified this problem back in 2005, before I ever really started writing publicly. I started a blog, my first blog, back in 2005, with the sole intention of writing something good enough to be accepted onto Lou Rockwell. Because at the time, all the intellectual heavyweights at the Mises Institute were writing for Lou Rockwell every day. And as far as I was concerned, that was the heyday of like the daily intellect of the internet. And then it just kind of all fell off, you know, it just all became, you know, Twitterati mush after that.
Yeah.
But, and I succeeded with my first article, and it took me some time, and I wrote about it. And I wrote about, you know, and my first article for Lou Rockwell I ever published publicly was about the economics of modern poetry, because I studied poetry when I was in college, and I saw what was wrong with the institutionalization of that art form, because they institutionalized it through government largesse and the government support of the arts through forcible taxation and giving out grants and whatnot, allowing, you know, destroying the vitality of a very important art form. Because it became guild speak, and it became this thing that was guarded by the guild masters within creative writing departments and English departments across the country. And they destroyed the art form.
And modern
American poetry dies after Elizabeth Bishop in the 1950s.
All right. Before you get into the weeds, let me help some people catch up there. So what?
Sure.
Let me translate in some ways. A elitist government organization, one that wielded power from funds from the government, the taxpayer was created, and then they became these people that could fund, grant, select, choose this art form and decide
what was good in that art form.
Yes.
Decided what that art form was. And I ran smack into this when I was an undergraduate in college, and I fought against it the entire time. I didn't know what was going on until I was able to, in my 30s, reflect on it. And I was chatting, and one of my friends from that time period were both poets. Well, I'm not a poet anymore, but he still is. He's actually doing very well in that. And he's a leftist and a Marxist, and you know, we still get along famously, believe it or not. But we remember talking about some of these things as I was going through my conversion to libertarianism, which started right around 2000. And, you know, by 2005, I had a sophisticated enough understanding of Austrian economics to understand the mechanism by which they corrupted the poetry. And when I wrote the article and I sent it to him, he's like, "Tom, this is the most brilliant thing I've ever read, because it absolutely described what happened." And the good poets who were the poet laureates at these creative writing departments in the universities were kind of shut off from the bureaucrats and the midwits, what we would call today midwits, who ran the departments and ran the bureaucracy of the departments and decided what students were able to even study.
Yes, through this government, this government institution, this government tool, a bureaucracy was created, mm-hmm. and then the bureaucrats became the overlords, the gatekeepers of something that's supposed to be free for people to decide, an art. And they became the gatekeepers of what that art form is.
And destroyed the vitality of the art form. And when you're destroying the vitality of the art form, you're undermining the culture.
Yes.
It doesn't matter if we're talking about a marginal one like poetry, or even an even more marginal one like classical music. Now, at the same time, somebody said, the same person said to me, he's like, well, what happened to classical music? I said, classical music is actually more vibrant today than it ever was. Not because the community orchestras and the city-run orchestras that are funded by taxpayer money, all they can do is put a couple of concerts on a year and do the greatest hits, right? Yes. Beethoven and, you know, Bach and Mozart or whatever. They're really good. They can do Mozart, right? And where is classical music, like orchestral music, where is it? It's all over the place. You see it every day. The film industry has created untold amounts of brilliant orchestral music over the last 70 years in writing film and television scores. And composers are working today and making great music, which is supported by, you know, for the most part, an open, a free market process. The art form of telling, of marrying music text and music sound, speech and pictures into movies, right? Mm-hmm. Very powerful art form. And you take all of that and then you marry it with music, and it's like the most powerful art form. It's movies are an unbelievable sermon. Or telling us metaphorically true stories, right? As yes. well, which, you know, are tremendous stuff. So whenever the ultimate point here is that when you see that process in play, and then when you start looking at every system like that, and this is why I picked poetry, because it's like the most marginal thing in our society, and marginalized thing in our society, at least as of 2005. And I said, if they can destroy that, well, they can destroy anything with this mechanism, because the mechanism is the same. F.A. Hayek described this mechanism brilliantly in the Road to Serfdom, which a lot of conservatives have read. Right. But they won't take the leap and read Human Action by Mises or Man, Economy, and State by Rothbard and take that next intellectual leap. And again, not because we want to beat anybody over the stick with the rightness of our argument, but because we use it as a filter to see where we've gone wrong so we can find moments where we can fix things and we can fix little things that are under our control and understand that and that we may not have a solution to a problem. Right. I don't have all the solutions. I mean, all I can do is like analyze the world, but I don't have solutions to everything. But I'm also humble enough to realize, because of the non-aggression principle, and because I firmly believe in not using aggressive force to achieve social or political goals, that just because I can't see a problem, see a solution to a problem, doesn't mean that one doesn't exist and that somebody right around the corner will as well. And almost every authoritarian you meet is a person who cannot separate that moment, that moment of humility of saying, of trusting that somebody else out there has a better idea, has a better solution. They don't trust it. They want to see it before they're willing to believe it. And there's a leap of faith involved in this. And I'm not necessarily a religious man, though I kind of am. I'm kind of recovering Catholic because I grew up in a Catholic Italian household in New York. But I am a spiritual man, and I do realize that that's the basis of spirituality, is that leap of faith or that trust that your fellow man's got this.
Yeah.
You know, and you have to believe that. And if you can't believe that, then just take care of that which you can take care of, which you can control, and stop trying to take on responsibility and control things that are not your responsibility. And the minute you do that, you become an anarcho-capitalist.
Okay. So it's more of a philosophical concept to live mm-hmm. your life by, even daily Absolutely. Decisions, than Absolutely. It is some sort of structure that's trying to replace what we have now.
No, because the thing is, and this is something that's really funny, in my first article about Bitcoin, going back to 2010, by the way, when I read the Bitcoin white paper in June of 2010, I wrote my first article on Bitcoin for Lou Rockwell in July 2010. The first draft of that article, I got to the ending of the article, and I made the mistake of saying, this is the solution to all of our monetary problems. And Lou Rockwell didn't always push back on me, but he pushed back on me there. He said, Tom, I'm not really crazy about the ending here, because I don't think that saying it like this at this point in time is smart. Better to let a thousand flowers bloom, which is where that phrase comes from. It comes literally from that email, because I've used it many times in other articles. And Lou said that to me. He's like, I like the phrase, let a thousand flowers bloom, meaning allow for the possibility that there are a thousand other potential solutions to our problems out there, but we know what the problems are. And now let's go let the market figure out and let the people figure out, as the collective wisdom of the neural network that is all of us, say, okay, let's figure out what the next solution is going to be, because we're not sure what it's going to be. Because it's funny that, you know, you look at what's happening today, right? We're all worried about the election on in November 4th.
Absolutely.
Right? And one man is driving so much of this. It's Klaus Schwab over at the World Economic Forum. Klaus Schwab thinks he's the smartest man in the room. And maybe he is, but he's not smarter than the room. Because the collective wisdom of 9 million or 7 billion people is far greater than the potential accumulated knowledge of any one man or any 100 men or any 1,000 men.
Absolutely. Okay, so let me stop again. So just to try to get that 50,000-foot view of what you're talking about, because you just brought up something great, talking about the man versus the room. In this anarcho-capitalist structure, you're talking about trusting the fellow man to innovate, that we are good people, and that eventually grand innovation will come, versus one man, one bureaucratic structure pointing, guiding, telling man where to go, where to innovate.
Well, that's part of it. And I don't think people are good, by the way.
Okay.
I don't have a good, I tend to have a positive view of people. I tend to believe that people respond to incentives. Like I'm no Pollyanna here.
Yeah.
Like I'm as big a cynic as you'll ever meet. I believe that people respond to incentives. I believe that the law of diminishing marginal utility and the law of supply and demand, which is an outgrowth of the law, is really a corollary of the law of diminishing marginal utility, drives all human behavior in economic terms, meaning that the first unit of something you acquire is the most important. That first guitar, the starving man, that first morsel of food. But the second one is important, but not as important. The third one is not as important as the second one, and on and on and on, until eventually, if you have, well, the best one is, you know, if you're dying of thirst, and that first sip of water is the most important, eventually, you know, too much water will drown you.
Yes.
Right. So there's a cycle. So the law of diminishing marginal utility creates economic and behavioral cycles. Right. It's why Thomas Malthus was wrong about the food supply and population and all of this stuff. And so when you understand that there's all these cycles that are happening, and there's cycles to our behavior, and there's cycles to the way we process around the sun, and there's all, and the Mercer magnetic fields and the dynamos within and all the stuff that's happening. Right. When you realize that, and you know that none of that stuff is under your control, except that which you decide to do with your next 10 minutes of your life or 20 minutes of your life or next hour of your life. And all we're really trying to do when we act is to alleviate the fear of the future so that we can plan more accurately or more, not accurately, but more confidently about our future. And the more confident we are about our future, the bigger our time horizons.
Yes.
This is the false argument of the authoritarians, is that only government can think beyond the next quarter. Like, I hear that at every freaking moldy old commie I've ever heard in my entire life. I'm like, no. People who have had their lives atomized and who just lost their job, they're not thinking in terms of what's going to be, what, you know, what's going to kill us 12 years from now. No one could care about climate change right now. It's the dumbest thing for them to actually be trying to push. And you'll notice that's really not on the docket for this election, because they've atomized people's expectations to the point of, how am I going to live next week?
Yes.
Right. So that's what we Austrian economists call high time preference, right? Low time preference is when we're satisfied with our current state. We've got food in the freezer. I've got a decent job. I got, you know, $5,000 in the savings account. I've got a 401k worth a little bit of money and some insurance, and everything's cool. Hey, I can, you know, buy a new car. Hey, I could, you know, put an addition on my house. Hey, I could maybe start a small side business, or, you know, whatever. Right. I can think about longer term plans. I can do that kind of thing. I can put that money towards lower time preference stuff, and lower time preference stuff is more interest rate sensitive. This is, again, a tenet of Austrian economics and why the Austrian business cycle works the way it does. And again, it's an outgrowth, a simple outgrowth of the law of diminishing marginal utility. And so why we Austrians all know that the monetary system, for example, is going to fail. We don't know when it's going to fail, but we know it's going to fail. We know it's going to fail because the system has manipulated the cost of money and the interest rate sensitivity so much that it has created all of this investment in things that are fundamentally uneconomic. And it's created a false reality, a kind of matrix that has to be eventually liquidated. And what they're doing now is they're printing money to stop the assets that they've overvalued from deflating in value, because the people who are politically connected and the ones wielding all of this power are the ones trying to keep those assets from deflating because they're the ones who are going to lose the most. They're going to lose their, not only their money, but their power and everything else. The best thing that can happen to the world right now is for massive deflation to take place. Savers would be improved dramatically. Food costs would drop like a rock. Energy costs would drop like a rock. The banks would all go out of business. Yeah, liquidity would be tough for a few months, but you know, so what? Everybody can go on to a net 60 or net 90 credit with their, with their local supply chain stuff. They'll get it. We'll get it done. We're on this boat together at that point. You know, what else are you going to do? All right. But the bad guys who have centralized the control over money, which is the expression of your ability to take your behavior and deploy your time, your only true scarce resource, profitably. And they've said, well, no, you're not allowed to do that until we get 1%. Excuse me, we got a 1% VIG.
Yes. Okay. Let me.
No.
Let me interrupt yeah, you sure. here and take the reins because we've sure. gone off of anarcho-capitalism, which really. I think you described, really well. I'd never thought of it like that before
sure.
as a philosophy of almost living your daily life versus so I've always thought of it as a structure. The structure mm-hmm. I didn't understand that libertarians wanted to replace, and it's not right. that at all. And we can get back to it, but on my notes today, I wanted to talk to you about Fed policy, and you've just mm-hmm. naturally brought us right in. And it's right. it's something I know you know a lot about. I get confused when I read about Judy Shelton and I read about the gold standard and I read mm-hmm. about these natural cycles, the way these overlords create this boom-bust system. And you can clearly mm-hmm. see in the age of Trump, for decades, that our national debt has risen and risen and risen. And now in the age of Trump, so much of what he does as a libertarian, I applaud and I see the way he's going contrary to previous right. administrations, but in terms of monetary policy, in terms of debt, in terms of, that's something that's big with libertarians is freedom
yes, it is.
And debt. And he has accelerated this debt to levels that we can no longer have any sort of interest rates at all. They would completely crumble the system as soon as the Fed increased the interest rates. So I've just spit out a lot there. Can you please help me understand where are we at with Fed policy? Some have told me that the Fed has merged with the Treasury, and there's a famous
yes.
article that Zero Hedge republished, that ends with, the Fed meets your new chairman, Donald J. Trump, something like that.
Right. I'll be happy to unpack as much of that as possible. Where we are with Fed policy is the Fed is trapped, and it's trapped for what I described before. Before that, and which is that because the Fed has destroyed, they haven't completely destroyed our bond market. Like, we're not Japan and we're not Europe.
Okay.
Like, neither of those bond markets function at this point. The ECB and the European Central Bank and the Bank of Japan, the BOJ, are the bond markets in those two markets, right? I saw a thing this morning on either Twitter or, I think it was on Twitter, right, just before we jumped on the call. That Italian debt is trading at the lowest point in the last 700 years.
Okay.
Its lowest rate, which is insane because the Italians are, hopelessly mired in, debts. They're beyond debt saturation. They're into, there is no market for Italian debt. But the ECB has crushed rates down to almost nothing. Now, they're doing that because they're eventually going to repudiate all the debt, convert them all into perpetual bonds, paying 0%, and basically screw everyone. That's what's coming in Europe. Okay, mm-hmm. For the Fed, and because the Fed, and again, I have my quibbles with him, and I talk about this stuff all the time. Martin Armstrong is fundamentally right about the fact that there's not going to be hyperinflation here in the United States until there's a shift in the center of the monetary system to another country, and someone else becomes the core economy. We are still the driving economy of the world. We're still the driving, money in the world, right? And I actually got a reminder this morning with his, we're recording this on Sunday the 18th, his blog from Sunday the 18th, someone asked him about, is the Fed going to introduce an e-dollar or a digital dollar? And he basically said we can't really do that because there's too many physical dollars being held overseas. Like, there's more physical U.S. banknotes being held outside of the United States as hoarded savings.
Yes.
The same way that Americans are hoarding gold, right? But you know, but Thais and Turks and Azeris and, you know, South Africans, they're hoarding dollars because to them, dollars are what they need in order to
dollar,
be able to...
Dollar is king. Dollar is the foundation of the
modern the world, monetary system.
Yes, of the it's a world structure now.
Sure.
So therefore,
but it's
we
not,
cannot
but
fail.
It's, right. And we're not going to fail in the short term. This is why Trump can get away with printing all this debt, because at the same time we have this, we also have global deflation happening in asset prices, in stocks, in bonds, all that. But why is the ECB and the BOJ in there manipulating their bond markets and trying to keep those prices from falling, the bond prices from falling? Because they can't afford to allow that to happen. Because if they did, the whole system would collapse, the governments would fail, and their grand project for recreating the USSR in Brussels would fail.
Yeah.
I mean, no, it would fail. So they're going to move to repudiating the debt, and they can get away with that because they're not a core economy. It's going to, by the way, we're already seeing it in the markets. What we're seeing here in the United States is, and that's also giving us an even bigger put underneath the dollar, because all of that capital that's now rightly scared of a no-deal Brexit and a potential for a great reset in early in 2021. And look, all the people in the know in Europe have already been briefed on all this. So that money is very slowly being pushed into U.S. markets, which is why we're not going to see a bond route here in the United States. We're not going to see a major crash in the Dow. We may see a 3-day correction that takes 25% off the market, but then it'll roar right back, just like we've seen in the last 5 years. And it doesn't matter at this point, because the United States is going to be the destination for the capital. And when Trump wins, and I say when, not if, but when Trump wins in 2 weeks, everybody who has bet against the dollar on this idea that Europe is fixed and the U.S. is not, and the U.S. is going to die, which is what they're trying to create. But when that doesn't happen, they're all going to be mispositioned, and they're all going to be sending their money over here, and the dollar is going to go through the roof. And you're going to see the dollar, gold, U.S. treasuries, and U.S. stocks all rise concurrently.
Interesting. So let me get back to the Fed policy. One thing that you've kind of outlined there is the money's coming in globally to the dollar, because we are the safe haven. We're the dollar is king. We're the foundation. So, you know, when they've accumulated wealth in their local areas, they're seeking U.S. assets or dollars as a safe haven in some ways. Is that savings we just talked about? Mm-hmm. You're worried about your future. They're trying to protect that future. But what's confused me here is, when I've read up, basically it says, and to bring it back to the Fed, that the Fed is pumping money into the stock market, that the Fed has been the one that's propping up the stock market, and we're just basically pouring assets onto the Fed balance sheet that's mm-hmm. kind of propping up the stock market and markets in general, keeping them from failing. You're saying it's more than that. It's also global money coming in.
Yes. It's a mixture of things, Jay. It's not any one thing. And this is part of the thing. I'm not shy about this stuff. I mean, yeah. I'm small potatoes in this. So I'm the yip dog yipping at people's, like Peter Schiff's heels, and getting angry with him openly and saying, look, you're not wrong about gold in the long term. You're not wrong about the dollar in the long term, but you're wrong about it right now. I mean, just stop it. You're wrong. The only reason the dollar fell this summer is because they were creating the narrative that Joe Biden was going to win the election and that the United States was going to die politically. They were impeaching Trump. They inflated the death certificate. The craziness over COVID. They locked down the economy. They tried to literally destroy and burn our society to the ground.
Yes.
I'm like, so, okay, that's fine. You did that. That's why the dollar fell on versus the euro. But it only really fell versus the euro. Go look at it versus the Turkish lira. Go look at it versus the Russian ruble. Go look at it versus everything other than the euro and the Chinese yuan. Everything else it's up against. Okay, the U.S. dollar index is a very poor measure of the U.S. dollar strength, by the way.
Okay,
it's terribly weighted towards the euro. The Chinese yuan's not even part of the friggin' index. Okay. It's mostly made up of the euro, the yen, and the pound. Like 85% of the US dollar index is that. So when you see it, and I chart the USDX for my patrons all the time, and talk about it. But I always talk about it with the caveat that we're really talking about it versus, you know, those three quote unquote Western economies. Because as far as I'm concerned, Japan might as well be the 51st state of the United States. So, but my problem here is with so many commentators is they're always focused only on the United States and don't see the bigger picture. Again, going back to Martin Armstrong, he's right. It's a global and connected system, and things that happen in Europe have an effect on the United States. And yes, the Fed has propped up asset prices. I also disagree with Martin Armstrong that there is no inflation, that deflation is the big thing. I'm like, no, we've had asset inflation. We have the S&P 500 trading at a Shiller PDE, trailing 10-year PDE of what's it, the second highest in history, only behind the dot-com bubble. Like, you want to know where the inflation went? It went there. You want to know where the inflation is? It's sitting with $2.85 trillion worth of excess reserves sitting on the Fed's balance sheet, getting paid a quarter of a point to the banks. That's where the money is. They refuse to actually let the money printed circulate, because if it did, we'd have hyperinflation, and we'd have hyperinflation in the core economy, which would destroy the rest of the world, right? Because okay. if we've got runaway inflation, imagine what it would look like in Turkey. Imagine what it would look like in Venezuela or Chile or Mexico, or, you know.
Absolutely. Our structure, again, is the foundation. Insane. Yeah, like
the Philippines would explode tomorrow. Poor Duterte, they probably lynch him. I mean, because it would be crazy. So the Fed is doing what they always do, and which is what Jim Sinclair used to call management of perspective economics, or MOPE, right? They manage perspective. That's all they do, and they try to keep everybody from panicking. Because as long as the markets kind of feel like everybody's in control and we're all willing to believe in the consensual hallucination that these people are competent, then the markets remain competent and the markets remain liquid. But when that facade fails, or more appropriately, when something within the system that they couldn't control finally collapses, a major Italian bank, something, then they have to scramble and deal with it, because the knock-on effects are always going to be huge. And I don't know where the next crisis is going to start. Most likely European banks. But when it starts, the next one, it's going to be big. And I'm actually really surprised that they've been able to hold, that we haven't had a September meltdown, to be honest with you. We had a very short correction at the beginning of October, but I don't consider that, you know, that wasn't enough to change the government like we had in 2008.
Yeah.
Right.
So then where are we headed? Because the debt is unattainable. We can't increase interest rates because it would completely bankrupt the United States. We wouldn't be able to pay. Everybody would, this tax farm that has been created, that is you, that is me paying in, we wouldn't be able to handle the load of normal interest rates. So where are we headed then? Because some people think, oh, the gold standard, or, you know, there's people on the fringe that talk about this Jassara and Nisara and some sort of debt jubilee.
I actually believe we're closer to to some versions of debt jubilee than I agree with Jim Rickards on that. I think we do need debt. Certain debts do need to be jubileed, and just dealt with. But the banks have to take it on the chin. The banks have to take it on the balance sheet, and the banks are in control of public policy, so the banks won't take it on the chin. And until someone's willing to stand up to them, and I'm not saying that person is Donald Trump, but Donald Trump is trying to fix a deeper problem. He's trying to fix a permanent bureaucracy that thinks that believes it's been empowered to run the world, and a web of corruption that's so deep that we don't even have democratic any kind of facade of democratic institutions of the rule of law, right? I mean, look, I'm an anarchist, but I do believe in law. Right. I don't necessarily believe that the government should be, you know, adjudicating that law. I mean, again, this is at the fringe of the, you know, when taking the philosophy to its grand logical conclusion. We don't live in that world. That may be the world I want, but it's not the world I got.
Yes.
And it's not the world I analyze. Right. I understand I would prefer the rule of law, and I would prefer the Constitution. Right. I mean, I'm an anarchist. I like the Constitution. Now, the Constitution is not bad. I like the Articles of Confederation better. But, you know, I don't have those. I've got the Constitution. And when I look at what I've got, my options in Europe, I'll take our Constitution. Thank you very much. I'm not stupid, right? Don't let the perfect be the enemy of the good and all that stuff, right? So, but we don't even have that. We don't have the rule of law. Why is Hillary Clinton not in jail? She's clearly guilty of crimes against humanity that, you know, stack up there with the greats. Her, Biden, Obama, all of them. They're all guilty. Brennan, Comey, Clapper, all of them. They're all guilty. They can't get through the bureaucracy.
And just
they can't get through. They can't get through the Senate. So that's Trump's problem right now. And for right now, since he's got the ability to print money and not have it really blow back on us in the short term, he's actually got the opportunity to keep everything liquefied for a little while we work out some of these other problems. My problem with Donald Trump is that he doesn't see the bigger picture of how his foreign policy is alienating so many people to then want to ditch the dollar, that 10 years from now, all those dollars that are hoarded overseas are going to come flowing back to us, and it's going to get they'll have changed over, and they'll be doing bilateral trade in their own local currencies, and you'll probably see something like the Russian ruble be the local reserve currency for the growing Asian, you know, consensus that's coming together in Central Asia. This is why I focus so much on geopolitics, because I can see how the trend towards de-dollarization, certainly from basically Turkey eastward, okay, across the entire Asian landmass, is eventually going to come back and bite us badly. And Trump is doing nothing right now but antagonizing all those people, thinking that he's defending America by using the dollar as a weapon to get short-term wins and long-term losses. He's getting tactical wins and strategic losses.
Different ways to go here, but I want to bring it back. I think the yuan is the obvious, you know, there's going to be some sort of system, you know, where there's not just the dollar across the globe. There's going to be some other platform that countries will jump off on. But I want to bring it back to that poetry analogy, because it was so good. Now, if you extrapolate that, people have a hard time seeing that 50,000 foot view of what the globalists have created across the globe. And you can see it in the fact of all these bureaucracies that are outside of the United States. They're no longer bound to the United States, but they control other markets and other countries. Just look at the World Health Organization, the World Trade Organization. Those actually aren't these top-level groups and organizations. Those are controlled by other fiefdoms that have come up, like the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, the Clinton Foundation, the Council on Foreign Relations. All of these almost secretive in some ways, all of these groups have their tentacles into these bureaucratic organizations that have been created under the name of good, you know, melding our global societies together, when in fact that there is profit at the center of what they're doing. And one of my best podcasts was where I went through Trump's UN speech. It was right at the point of impeachment, where they were walking down the hall and media was so distracted with impeachment. Trump had a UN speech at that time. It's one of my most popular podcasts I've done, where he outlines his theories and philosophies of sovereignty. And he's trying to me, you know, if you look back, he's trying to break these bureaucratic structures that have their tentacles all over the globe to bring it back to what you are talking about, where you need to trust your neighbor and worry about your local local systems, whether it be your city, then your county, then your state, then your country. Trump's saying we need to allow other countries and other local municipalities in their local area to concern themselves with themselves, no longer worried about what's going on, you know, how we're going to bring trade to Rwanda or bring North Korea in on this. Just allow the local systems to manage themselves.
Yes. No, the most dangerous. Why do you think they always freak out whenever Trump and Putin are alone in the room together?
Yeah.
Because Trump and Putin are both sovereigntists. It's Putin more so than Trump. Okay. Same thing with Viktor Orban in Hungary. Same thing with Nigel Farage in the UK. Same thing with Matteo Salvini in Italy. Same thing with President, you know, Duterte, Rodrigo Duterte in the Philippines.
Okay. Yes.
And these are all tremendous men. of immense character. They all have their flaws, every one of them, but they're all men of immense character.
And patriotism for their own local.
Yes, yes. No, I mean, as reflective of their own, of the culture that they're trying to defend.
Yes.
They are working against people who do not, who believe that the nation, that individual cultures and individual tribes and individual, and those types of things, and the nation state is what's causing strife in the world. That is, they're partially right in that nation states, which are fundamentally aggressive, right? Because governments are fundamentally aggressive because they are force first and everything else second. But the replacement for the nation state is not a transnational new Soviet man either. That's the fallacy of the modern left. The modern left sees this idea that we can destroy culture, we can destroy religion, we can destroy meaning, we can destroy value, we can destroy everything, and then we can build you back up as an atomized person in the form that we choose you to be. It is incredibly
yes.
It's fundamentally anti-human.
It's authoritarian.
It's offensive at every level, and all it really is a bunch of hubristic jackasses sitting around all day blowing smoke up each other's rear ends. Because I'm trying to not do this and use invective like I do on my live streams, because that's my bailiwick. But they're just blowing smoke up each other and puffing each other up, telling each other how smart they are while they live in their ivory towers, having never truly worked a day in their lives.
Yeah, having no connection to that local, to what we're talking about.
Yeah, no. And worse than that, Jan, because I literally just wrote this and I published the latest issue of the Gold Goats and Guns newsletter for my investment newsletter for my subscribers. And I always do an editorial. The last article of every newsletter is an editorial. And it's something that goes back to my days at Newsmax, where they recognized that they said, you should do an editorial in your newsletter every month. It's a different kind of thing. Just write whatever you want. And what I was saying this month was that, and even if they did, these people, even if they did spend a day amongst the people living amongst us, you know, like the old Roman emperors used to do, they'd go out dressed as commoners and spend the day living the life of their subjects, they wouldn't see our lives on our terms. All they would see is what is reflected, you know, in their own heads is, oh, well, no, this just tells me even more that I have to, you know, alleviate these people's suffering because yeah. I'm the messianic. They have this messianic God complex, thinking that that we're too dumb to make the big hard decisions, so they have to go out and kill millions of people. I don't know if you've ever seen or read Alan Moore's Watchmen, but you know they are Ozymandias in that story. And they're just waiting for the moment when they can drop the big alien on top of New York City, kill 6 million people to bring the world together, and then scream in adulation, we did it.
Wow.
And, you know, that's not going to work. It's not what's going to happen. What's going to happen is there's going to be 6 million dead people, or in their case, 60 million dead people. And a whole bunch of destroyed lives on top of that, and billions of lives destroyed on top of that, and everybody angry and fighting amongst themselves. That's what's going
to
happen.
Just to bring it back to the anarcho-capitalism and that philosophy, which marries up with Trump and what he's trying to do, what he outlined in that UN speech and the concept of sovereignty, how do we eliminate these bureaucratic structures that have been built over decades that are intertwined with everything? You know, just look at our pandemic. We're getting our information from a computer scientist, not a doctor. And just today on Twitter, Scott Adams, Scott Atlas, thank you. The medical advisor, he's been blocked or suspended on Twitter for his opinions against masks, and it's madness. How do you see that going? Because
it getting much worse before it gets better.
Well, and that's kind of what I'm saying.
I'll be honest, and I don't mean to be flip about that. Again, I'm an artist first, Jay, right? I'm a writer first, an artist first, and I'm a political analyst second. So I trained myself as an artist to the first 35 years of my life, and I've been training myself as a political analyst and overlaying that. And so, and my people get my hardcore people get angry at me when I want to talk about Star Wars, or I want to talk about The Lord of the Rings, or I want to talk about Dune, or I want to talk about all these great stories, or hell, these are the stories that for me are, for lack of a better term, they're my Bible. Right?
Yeah. Well, they're triumphs of man over these systems. They are
the great stories. They are great archetypal stories that teach lessons. And artists always get there first, my friend.
Mm-hmm.
Always. So, meaning, like, I did a podcast a few months ago about The Dark Knight Rises, right as the Chaz and the Chop were happening.
Yes, it was great. It was a great podcast, and I encourage people to go and look at past episodes.
So I never appreciated that movie when I watched it because I wasn't sure of Chris Nolan's politics because of all of the, you know, the stupid energy, you know, we have to solve the world's energy problem thing, which is such a screams Hollywood leftist, right? That I wasn't sure of what he was doing. I wasn't sure if he was on Bane's side or not. I couldn't tell what was going on. And then when I watched The Dark Knight Rises again recently, I'm like, oh my God, the guy was like 12 years ahead of his time. He was telling us in 2008, writing the story in 2006, 2007, of what was going to happen after Occupy Wall Street, after they screwed everything up and blew everything up in 2008. Like, it's insane how prescient the movie is. And how important it is that artists see what's happening first. And so that's one example. The Wachowski brothers saw it with The Matrix. I strenuously argue that the Star Wars sequel trilogies, episodes 7 through 9, are telling us exactly what's wrong with our gender roles here in our, and those movies have been lambasted as overwoke, and they're exactly the opposite of it. It's exactly the opposite of it at the end of the day. When you get down to the final, in the final analysis, those movies are supportive of traditional gender roles and the fact that we need to get back to a Christian definition of marriage and all of these things. Like, and it's right there in front of you if you have eyes to listen, if you have eyes to see and ears and are willing to listen. But we're also so cocked up by the anxiety that these overlords spew at us all day long. We can't even see our own art anymore. And it's a shame. And, you know, people are going through it today and they're not ready to hear that message. They will be in about 10 years. But I can tell you that, you know, for example, I say this all the time, like my 14-year-old daughter adores the new Star Wars films. And she now has a means by which to go. She loved the Hunger Games as well for the exact same reason, that this was a roadmap for a young girl to navigate times of chaos and retain her humanity. And she needed that. She needed those lessons. And that's a fundamentally good thing. It's going to take two generations to rebuild our cultural institutions. One of the things I've heard about Russia that is very interesting is, in the 1990s, no one was going to church in Russia in the 1990s and back then. And the parents would have to drag the children to church, right? Something like that. And today the kids are dragging the parents to church and they're building 1,000 churches across Russia right now. But the whole Russian-speaking world, that includes, you know, Belarusia and Ukraine and other places, that across everywhere where the Russian Orthodox Church is ascendant, and, you know, the other aspects of the Eastern Orthodox Church, we're seeing that because they're returning from four generations of an entire generational cycle where they where culture failed and where Marxism destroyed the spiritual aspects of the institutions. The restoration is what's coming back. Because again, everything comes in cycles, and that's what gives me hope for the future, obviously. But in the process, we're going to have to go through what could be, you know, a period that looks a lot like 1939 to 1945. And
that's scary.
I don't want to I don't want to live through that. And I didn't want to bring my daughter into it because I could see it back in 2003, 2004 that we shouldn't, you know, but my wife was wiser than me. So we had a child and tried to have a second one. So.
All right. Well, I love talking to you. I really appreciate you because now we've gone down another thread that I want to talk about, and that, you know, that's the Russian boogeyman and who's behind that. And I appreciate you and I are on the same wavelength where, you know, if you take a big step back, there is absolutely no reason at this point that our countries should be enemies when we discuss, you know, economic agreements and things like that. Russia should be up on the list, and Trump has that focus of trying to, I don't want to say normalize relations, but just trying to take a step back. And it's this global structure, this bureaucratic structure, that has pushed NATO beyond the agreement, right to the right to the doorstep of Russia. And so many of my neighbors and so many of my friends, they have a hard time seeing that because we're inundated with Russia, 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 communist narrative. Meanwhile, we've got the atheists over in Asia that are in full totalitarian control of their society, that we're supposed to be, just glad-handing friends with, helping them create their society. It's a very strange, complex narrative that's been built where our government is married with our media, and it's completely juxtaposed to what I think our society would feel.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no. That's the last thing they want is for the United States, the last bastion of individualism. Remember, they still haven't disarmed us.
Absolutely.
Right? And it's why the Great Reset will not work here, because they haven't disarmed us and they're not going to disarm us. If anything, and I'll get to Russia in just a second, but this, if anything, to give you hope, is the fact that there's now 30 million new gun owners in America, all first timers. And They're ready. The response to COVID-19, the response to the George Floyd riots and Antifa and BLM was exactly the right one. Oh, no, government can't protect me. When seconds count, the police are minutes away. Well, guess what? I guess I need to own a gun now. And you can't find for months you couldn't find a self-defense weapon in the United States, or self-defense ammo, or hell, plinking ammo for a reasonable price. I mean, when 9mm is going for 65 cents a round, there's something wrong. Okay. So. And I'm not even talking about, like, you know, hot loads or, you know, defensive rounds. I'm talking about 115 grain, you know, full metal jacket, ball, plinking ammo, go to the range, learn how to shoot your gun ammo, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, stuff that I don't even like buying because I don't train with it anymore in 9mm. I train with 147 grain jacket at hollow points or 124 grain jacket at hollow points. And I just pay the extra money and be done with it. With Russia, culture is reasserting itself. The United States, the culture doesn't want to die. They've destroyed the movie theater, as I've said now, right? They're trying to destroy our ability to tell stories of consequence within the entire movie complex. That was the whole point of the Marvel films, was to destroy meaning by giving us a pale impression of what the heroic story was supposed to look like. Right. Every once in a while, they'd actually put out a good one here or there. You know, Guardians of the Galaxy.
Yes.
Doctor Strange was actually particularly good, I thought. Mm-hmm. Certainly by the numbers. What's happening in Russia? They don't want the United States and Russia to ever get together. But they've not wanted that for 150 years.
It's the boogeyman.
It's not. It's beyond that. It's about the two halves of Christianity uniting, Orthodox and Protestant / Catholicism, that's the last thing they want is for that to happen. They do not want Christianity uniting in any fundamental way at all, because that will upset the communist apple cart. That's why they tried to destroy the Russians with communism, and it didn't work. 85 years of communism. And it didn't work. The Orthodox Church is going to come back stronger in Russia today than it ever had, than it ever was before Lenin. So it's going to take another two generations. And Putin has done yeoman's work in getting people's time horizons out of the gutter and out of, you know, this week. And You know, suicides are down, drug addiction is down, alcoholism is down, abortions are down. I mean, abortions as a percentage of live births are down 90% under Putin.
Wow.
Abortion was the preferred method of birth control in Russia coming out of the communist era and in, and through the Yeltsin years. Okay. I've done all these. I haven't talked about this stuff in years, and I haven't written about it in a long time. But go and look at the, you know, go to the Russian state statistics on just, you know, the demographic statistics, and it's all findable at the Russian website. It's not hard, and you'll see the numbers are stark. But it just comes from giving people something to giving people, you know, the beginnings of a purpose and the beginnings of a future, and then they'll take it from there. And Russia's got a lot of work to do. It's not, he's still got a tremendous amount of corruption to get rid of and everything else. But Putin has run Russia the way, the closest analog to, I think, to Vladimir Putin as far as a ruler would be as if Pat Buchanan had ever won here in the United States.
Interesting.
He governs like Buchanan, but remember, he took over during a time of lawlessness. So yeah, a lot of people died.
Yeah.
Like, No, and a lot of people were put in jail, and no one thought twice about it. But most of the people that were put in jail were CIA fifth columnists, you know, MI6 agents, all posing as journalists, and whatnot, or CEOs of companies that were, you know, I mean, like guys like Bill Browder, are freaking CIA assets and MI6 assets. Let's not kid ourselves or anything. Just call a spade a spade. So, so what's happening? So the last thing they want to have happen is for us to come together and for there to be any kind of detente. And the Russians and the Chinese have been asking us for 10 years now, but quite politely, let's create a multipolar world. Let's just sit down and carve the world up. And the United States has steadfastly said no, because the United States is actually run by globalists here who were in sympathy with those in Europe, the Bilderberg group / what I call the Davos crowd.
Sure.
And it's very obvious that they're the ones pushing for global totalitarian control, even over China. That's the part that no one really wants to understand. Like, what's driving some of Trump's policy is that that the conservative right is pushing him to be a hawk on China, because it's actually furthering the Davos crowd's plans for the Great Reset to bring China to their knees as well. That they're going to get rid of Trump, destroy the U.S., and then they're going to be able to use that combined might to then subjugate China. And the Chinese are too hip to this, and they've got the Russians in their back pocket, and the Russians are too hip to this too. The Russians see through all of this stuff. The Iranians do too, by the way, without a doubt. And but all of this is far away from anarcho-capitalism, because none of it has anything to do with people being able to live the lives that they're live their best life.
Yeah, we just went down a web of aggression versus non-aggression.
Right, exactly. And so you understand, you know how hard it is for me to get up every day and have to live in the minds of these tyrants with my view of the world?
Yeah.
How and do so without, you know, just wanting to take up a gun and start shooting people. Like, it's crazy. I mean, I say that facetiously, because again, I would never do that. But you do get to a point sometimes where you're looking at this going, why are we standing here taking it? Because that's the right thing to do. We'll take it until they just wear themselves out, until they run out of, you know, greater fools to sell their poison to. Right?
Well, we've got so much more meat on the bone. I thank you for joining me. We went down a lot of different rabbit holes, but I do want to speak to you again in the future, so we can go a little bit more in depth. You know, just at the ending there, you know, there is a light at the tunnel, and I like the way what I've learned about anarcho-capitalism today is it's kind of in the same vein as this Q movement that's coming about, where if we're going to defeat these bureaucratic structures that have been created, we need to volunteer more in our local communities. We need to give service to our system, our platform, our local municipalities, so that these global do-gooders that are actually authoritarians in their in their application, we can put patriotic people that respect sovereignty back into this structure, because there's only if you don't want to burn it down, then you have to almost cleanse it, or you know, almost like HCQ allows the zinc to go in and cure the virus. We need to get patriots and people that are libertarians and anarcho-capitalists in the way that they think. We need to inject them into the cells of our society.
Well, yes, and but really, again, go back to what I really believe, and this is the humility of it all, is that you just sit back and you go, okay, what can I fix today? You know, what burden can I take on today that I couldn't take on yesterday? The more burdens that I take on, the stronger I become, right? So, and those are very simple things, very little things. I'm going to fix that. What is it? Well, in my case, it was like I live on a private road in the middle of North Florida. That was terrible, and it was swallowing people's cars. Got organized, got a contractor, went out, and my wife did all the work. Found a contractor, and then went around to the neighborhood and said, "Let's raise the, you know, how much can you give us? We're going to put in this much. We'll run the job. Don't worry about it. We just need, you know, if you whatever you can bring in, so we can get the road fixed. Are you with me on this?" Yes, did it. Got the road fixed. You know, raise the $10,000 that was necessary, fix the road, and everybody's happier. And my entire neighborhood is better for it.
Yeah.
Okay. And that inspired the county to then fix the county road that attaches to our road. Okay. And we start there. And we don't look to government to solve your problems for you, because government is the one that created the problems for you in the first place. So politics got us into this mess. It certainly ain't going to get us out of it.
Okay.
Right. You know, it is about taking the responsibility, but not taking on more responsibility than you should, right? Staying humble and figuring it out. And that means strengthening your local community however you can. It means finding people that are like-minded to you. If it means joining a church or joining a social group, even if you're not religious, join a church. There's nothing wrong with it. They're good people. You might find that you can get locally sourced meat from a farmer, and you can get this from that guy, and all of a sudden you don't need to buy the stupid stuff you buy on Amazon. You can get it locally or whatever. It doesn't matter. At the end of the day, every community that is strengthened by that local web again is more resistant to whatever it is that they have planned for us. Because the more we resist them in our minds, the more expensive it becomes for them to oppress us. This is a game of attrition. This is a war of attrition against people who are deploying debt and pulling forward the future to oppress us in the present. And eventually you make it so expensive that they've pulled so far into the future that no one believes anymore that we could ever pay any of that back, which is about where we are now.
Yes.
Now we need a new monetary system. So if we resist them harder now, they'll create a patchwork of incompetence, right? They'll incompetently roll out, you know, central bank digital currencies and all this other rotten nonsense and the panopticon in our sewers and all this stuff that Whitney Webb is writing about. It all happen, and then it'll all just collapse because the bureaucracy is incapable of managing any of it. And then they'll feed it to their AIs, who have no concept of meaning and culture, and you know, all they have is correlations. And then there's just a self-referential cycle of bad decisions and bad and ever escalatingly erroneous conclusions to data. And if you want a great example of that, to close out talking about the election, Nate Silver, 538 guy, published his 270 to win map this morning of the election. He's got Biden winning 413 to 125 because he's using bad polling data and garbage in, and we have a garbage in, garbage out economy, information stream.
Yes.
And if you give us garbage, we're going to get garbage out. And his map is literally, it's been, I mean, nobody on the DNC believes that Biden's going to take 450 electoral votes.
No. And I saw that map, exact map that you're talking about. And I know that you and I are, are 3,500 miles apart. I'm in Washington. You're in Florida. When I saw that Florida was blue in his map, I laughed because if there's anything I see in terms of national metrics and things going the way of Trump, it's Florida. Florida is 100%.
Florida is so Trump country, it's not funny. Yes. He's going to take 45% of Hispanic men here in Florida.
Yes.
When he takes 45% of Hispanic men in Florida, if he takes that, if he takes anything north of 35%, he Biden loses Arizona, New Mexico, Florida, Texas, Louisiana, North Carolina, South Carolina. You go through the entire map, like all of them.
Well, just proximity to Cuba and all the lessons and the refugees, they can see right through this veil that's been put up about what the Democrats say they believe, and they just see right through that.
I'm telling you, the internal polling numbers here in Florida are, and the early voting results, the vote by mail stuff, and the registration statistics and everything else, they're off the charts. I called Florida +5 for Trump or +7 for Trump in 2016, and minus a bunch of egregious cheating in Broward and Dade, which we expect.
Yes.
He won by 3 or 4. So I was right, because I always had said, well, then they give it about 3 or 4 points for Broward and Dade fudging data. And yeah, I'm about right. I think he wins Florida by an honest 5 or 6 points with no problem. I think the bellwether for the election on the way out the door, because I do have to run in a minute. Is the following. If I'm hearing people from New York properly, a lot of people in New York are going to vote for Trump that would not normally vote for Trump. And he's not going to win New York, but he ain't going to lose it 68 to 32. He's going to lose New York 55-45. If he loses New York 55-45 and he loses New Jersey 57-43 or 56-44, forget it. He's going to sweep most of the rest of the country.
Yeah.
Okay. He's going to win. He's going to lose Oregon by 3 points.
Yeah, which is really just Portland.
Yeah. But even Portland, people are got to be like, I mean, I can't believe that people would believe after having their entire lives destroyed that they would vote for the very people who cheered it on.
This media focus is a very serious thing. I'm right out here in the thick of this, and I come across people all the time that that are seeing things from this headline news that's manufactured through Yahoo and Apple and the New York Times and all of the media pushing this negative Trump narrative. A lot of people do believe in that, but you've got to go. I'm not even going to give the reins back to you. You've got to go. We've gone everywhere in this discussion. I reserve the right to bring you back. We can talk about something else and weave down different roads another time. I want everyone to go check out the Gold Goats and Guns podcast. You can find everything else you need to lead you to his market analysis and his Patreon. You can find it through those platforms. Tom Luongo, thank you so much for coming on and speaking to us today.
I appreciate it, Jay. It was a good talk. It was a lot of fun. And you have a great day and don't despair.
All right.
Let's be friends. We're all on this cosmic spaceship together. Subscribe and share the Conservative Hippie Podcast. Visit our sponsors, smokinjays.com.
Everything for your smoking lifestyle.
Stonerhoroscopes.com.
Adora Zen dishes cosmic vibes for the stoner at heart.
Kickfromthespot.com.
Soccer is American.